Sergio Ramirez served as Nicaragua's vice president under Daniel Ortega from 1984 to 1990, but politics are just a part of what he does. He's written over 30 books, including 9 works of fiction. His novel, Margarita, How Beautiful the Sea, was published in Spanish in 1998, but it's recently been translated into English by Michael B. Miller, and it brought Sergio Ramirez to the show earlier this year. We are re-airing that conversation. I started out by asking him if he was surprised that it took nearly a decade for this book to be translated into English, given that it won Spain's prestigious Alfaguara Prize when it was first released.
Well, not always it is so easy for a Spanish writer to be translated into English, and especially because with this translation there were some difficulties to solve along many years. It is an special story, but it is a very good translation, and I think the reader in English is going to enjoy it.
Do you work with your translators?
Yes, I did. I did through the mails and working the language, trying to help them, to help him to solve difficulties. Well, sort of thing that happened with translations.
But I would assume partly because it's also a translation from Nicaraguan Spanish, because each country's Spanish is a little different,
yes.
Isn't it?
Yeah, you know, in France, they call the translation from the Guatemalan, from the Nicaraguan, from the Peruvian, not from the Spanish, because there are many kinds of Spanish in the Spanish world.
Translations sometimes reveal things that we don't always want to see. Octavio Paz was once here with his English translator, and he said that he'd look at the English translation of the poem that Stuart was giving him, and he'd say, oh, boy, there's a major flaw in this. And then he'd go back to his Mexican publishers and say, I have to change this poem, and they'd get very upset.
Well, with poetry, it's more difficult than with novels and short stories, of course.
Well, was there a political dimension to the reason that this took so long to be translated because of the role you played in Daniel Ortega's Sandinista government?
No.
Because there have been problems in this country. Some writers haven't even been allowed in this country because their political views have been deemed unacceptable.
Not in my case. I have not had those problems. And I am retired from politics since more than 10 years now, and dedicating myself only to writing, yes.
Although this book does have a political dimension. The title is taken from an actual event that took place in 1907 when Rubén Darío, a Nicaraguan journalist, diplomat, and influential poet, returned home. Now, he's been called the father of modernism, of Nicaraguan modernism or modernism?
Modernism in a general sense. Darío has an enormous influence in the literary world. At the beginning of the 20th century, he created this movement called modernism all around Latin America and Spain. Mm-hmm. He was the most influential writer at the beginning of the 20th century. And he created a new language. He renovated very deeply the Spanish language, and he is appreciated for that. For both in Nicaragua, more than that, he's a national hero.
Well, he had to be living in Spain?
Many years, in Argentina, in Chile first, then in Argentina, then in Spain, in France. He always lived abroad, and he only returned once to Nicaragua in 1907 when he was received triumphantly, that is the subject of the novel, and then to die in 1917.
What happened when he returned? Why
he was received like a hero, and for me, Darío is the character for a novel precisely because in a very little country with only 200,000 inhabitants and very small size in territory, he created a legend in Nicaragua. He created the idea that he was a national hero, even when very few people could read his poems, and he represents the country in many senses, and this is the reason why, for me, it's a novel's character.
What is the significance of the verses he wrote on Margarita's fan?
Well, you know, at that time it was very common for poets to write in fans. It was the style of the times, and he wrote this little poem for Salvadora Somoza, and a long poem for Margarita de Baile. Both of them were sisters, and this is the reason why the novel has this title, Margarita, What Beautiful the Sea, because of this this poem that is very famous not only in Nicaragua but all along the Spanish world.
Well, people who know anything about Nicaraguan history will recognize those names, Somoza and de Baile, because of the Somoza dictatorship, which then was also, the de Bailes were involved in that. But they weren't in power at the time that Darío returned, or they weren't negative figures then?
No, because the novel is putting together two different times. At the beginning of the century, the welcome that Darío received when he triumphantly returned to Nicaragua, and at the midst of the century in 1956, when Somoza is shot during a party in the city of León, when he was pretending to be reelected again as president of Nicaragua. The dictatorship had started back in 1934, and the life of Somoza ended in 1956 after he was shot by a young poet, Rigoberto López Pérez. Then I am putting together these two stories.
We have these parallel stories taking place 50
because,
years apart about two different poets.
Two different poets, yes. But the two stories are taking place in the same scenery, which is the city of León. And the link between the two stories is El Sabio de Baile, who is a very well-known, recognized doctor, graduated in La Sorbonne in Paris, who is the father of Salvadora Margarita de Baile. And then Salvadora became the Somoza's wife.
My guest is Sergio Ramirez. His novel, Margarita, How Beautiful the Sea, is available now in an English-language translation from Curbstone Press. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. When he came back, the day of Darío's return was full of promise for Nicaragua. Who was leading the country at that time?
Well, at that time, Nicaragua was under the military occupation of the United States. The troops of the United States came in 1909 to overthrow General José Santos Zelaya, which was the leader of the Liberal Revolution. And because of problems related with the construction of the Interoceanic Canal in Panama, Zelaya wanted to construct a different one in Nicaragua with the help of Germany and Japan. Then he came into trouble with the United States, and then he was overthrown. And then those are the times of Rubén Darío.
Now, a canal actually makes some sense if you look at the map, because there's this huge lake in the middle of Nicaragua, and it would have really have just involved a short break into the lake and another short break out of the lake. Mm-hmm. But why was Panama chosen rather than Nicaragua in the first place?
There are different reasons. One of them is that when it was being discussed in the Senate in the United States, there were two different radical positions, one for Panama, one for Nicaragua, and the enemies of the construction of the canal through Nicaragua show a postal stamp in which there was a volcano with fire and so on, and to demonstrate the danger that represented to build a canal through a country which had plenty of volcanoes.
But has any volcano ever had that kind of destructive power?
There are earthquakes in Nicaragua, but not provoked by the volcanoes, but for other natural phenomena.
So there was really the U.S. government had invaded. That was under who? Teddy Roosevelt?
Under President Wilson, I think.
Really?
I think.
So this is before World War One.
Before, yes.
And the excuse given was that...
Because Zelaya was endangering this regional security of Central America. Yeah.
Did Somoza wind up coming to power at the end of that occupation?
At the end of the second occupation, because there was a new civil war in Nicaragua that erupted in 1925.
Led by Sandino?
Sandino was fighting in the side of the liberal army that was fighting against the conservative army in power. And then the invasion of the United States troops came, and then Sandino rebels against this occupation, and then he started his own fight.
Now, as you said, the second narrative in this book involves Rigoberto Lopez Perez, who was actually born after Darío died. He assassinated Anastasio Somoza García in 1956. Do artists see themselves as playing a different role in Latin American society than they do in other parts of the world?
Yes, I think so. In the history of Latin America, writers, intellectuals has been always playing a different role, a political engagee role. And it is natural for us to participate in public life, to participate in revolutions, in changes, and intellectually to support changes ideologically. And then this is, I think, because the abnormality of the public life in Latin America, where institutions are not consolidated, but changes are abnormal. You have coup d'etat, revolution, military dictatorships. Then there is an enormous room for writers to be always protesting and rebelling against the given situations.
And they're big fish in little ponds, are they?
Yes.
I'm thinking about some of the people in just recent times. Mario Vargas Llosa ran for president of Peru. Not only you in Nicaragua, but also the poet-priest Ernesto Cardenal served in the Sandinista government. And I assume that there are many others that I'm either unaware of or I haven't
Along
remembered.
The history of Latin America, yes. Rómulo Gallegos, one of the well-known writers in Latin America who wrote Doña Bárbara, one of the high-ranking novels in our literary history, was president of Venezuela. Juan Bosch, another writer, was president of the Dominican Republic. Then there is this current of participation of intellectuals and writers in the public life.
But as you said earlier, you've given up on politics. Was that because your presidential bid failed in 1996?
In part, but in part, I have been in politics for 25 years. And then I decided that it was time for me to retire to come back to my own territory that was literature, because I was a writer when I entered politics, and I entered politics only because it was a revolution, not an ordinary policy that didn't interest me.
But you want to participate in changing the country?
Yes, of course, because it was a very deep thought, as a very deep, radical change in the political, social, and economic life of my country.
So you wrote this novel. This is the first book you wrote after you dropped out of politics, but I assume that you were thinking about your own political experiences when
yes,
you were writing this.
But taking into consideration that for 10 years I couldn't write. I didn't write a single word.
Because they weren't
occurring
to you? Because
I was very busy with
the
revolution. I was in government first in the fighting against the Somoza dictatorship, then working in the first years of the revolution. And then when I was elected vice president of Nicaragua in 1984, I thought that if I continued to be absent of my writing, I was going to abandon literature forever. And this thinking was insupportable for me. I didn't want to abandon literature. Then I started to write. In the most difficult times of the revolution, I started to write in the very, very early in the morning. This is the only way you can write.
Rigoberto Lopez Perez, as we said, was a poet. Was he working alone, or was he part of some movement?
Well, I will say he was an aficionado poet, not a professional poet. In Nicaragua, there is a lot of people that is always writing poetry, just because we all Nicaraguans are under the shadow of Rubén Darío. And then Rigoberto was 26. He didn't have any book published, of course. He only wrote poems in the papers and so on. But he was recognized as a poet.
But it still is ironic that Rubén Darío, the greatest poet of Nicaragua, was on friendly relations with the Somozas and the De Valles. Another man who admires Darío winds up assassinating Somoza. In fact, how was the Somoza family able to continue to hold on to power for 23 years until 1979, first with Luis Somoza de Baile, who ruled from 56 to 63, then Anastasio Somoza de Baile, who ruled from 67 to 72, and then again from 74 to 79. That's a lot of continuity.
Well, first, because in 1934, when the Marines abandoned Nicaragua, they had created a new army, the National Guard, that trained by the Marine themselves, and this army was put under the grip of Somoza, the founder of the dynasty. And then he has a kind of personal army, very repressive one, and the dictatorship was created because of the National Guard. It was the only possibility.
Well, the American president was FDR at that time. This does seem to be something that I wouldn't normally associate with Franklin Delano Roosevelt.
Yes, but Franklin Delano Roosevelt supported the Somoza family in power because perhaps he didn't want any kind of disturbances in the backyard of the United States that was Central America. And there is a phrase of Franklin Delano Roosevelt applied to Somoza when he said that once questioned about why the United States was supporting someone like Somoza, he answered, "He's a son of a bitch, but he sounds."
Our son of a bitch. Well, we weren't using the protect ourselves against the communist argument that became big later during the Cold War.
It started later during the Cold War. Then the pretext to support Somoza was the danger of communism not only in Nicaragua but in Central America in a general sense. In the Caribbean and Central America, when President Eisenhower met with all President Latin America in Panama, you had the dictatorship, military dictatorship, all over Latin America, in Cuba, in Dominican Republic, with Trujillo, Batista, Somoza, Castillo Armas in Guatemala, Rojas Pinilla in Colombia, Pérez Jiménez in Venezuela, and they all of them were supported by the United States because this pretext of the communist peril.
Were the sons an improvement over their father, the Somozas?
I wouldn't say that. When President Kennedy came to power and with all his proposal of democracy in Latin America and the Alliance for Progress, then the Somozas put a different person in power in the presidency, René Chic, and they wanted to give the appearance that they were democratizing the country, but the dictatorship didn't change in its nature.
My guest is Sergio Ramirez, whose novel Margarita, How Beautiful the Sea, is now available in an English translation from Curbstone Press. We're back with Sergio Ramirez, whose novel Margarita, How Beautiful the Sea, is now available in an English translation from Curbstone Press. Have you written any novels since?
This novel?
Yes, because this is 1998.
10 years ago. Yes, of course. I had two new novels after this one.
Are we going to see them in translation as well?
Yes. They are going to appear in English, yes.
When did you decide that Darío's poem would make a good metaphor for the reality and legend of the entire history of Nicaragua?
Well, Darío is... all the presence of Darío's in the Nicaraguan history is a complete metaphor. Then any poem he has written could be used to represent some part of the history of Nicaragua or of the history of Latin America in a general sense.
Even though he lived away from the area for so much of his life.
Yes, of course, of course. Precisely because of that, he was a legend in Nicaragua, the hero that lived abroad. And then he was considered someone like a hero.
Well, many Latin American writers and intellectuals have lived in exile because if they stayed at home, they'd wind up imprisoned. In his case, he went to Europe because that's where the intellectual action was?
Well, he went first to Chile when he was only 17. Because somebody helped him to go out of the country because he was a very talented man, a very imaginative man.
And was Chile the place to be at that time?
Yes, and Chile was a very important cultural place in Latin America at the end of the 19th century. They had good universities, cultural centers, libraries, and so on, and newspapers. Darío was a journalist.
And then he went to Argentina,
and
you say.
He trained as a journalist in the papers of Santiago de Chile, yes.
And then you say he went to Argentina, which was the most Europeanized
then,
of all the Latin American countries.
He came to Argentina because he was the correspondent for La Nación, who was the leading newspaper in Latin America and the Spanish world. Take into consideration that La Nación has a printing of about 200,000 copies per day, that it was enormous for Latin America at the end of the 19th century. And then Darío came to live in Argentina because he was appointed a consul for the government of Colombia. The president of Colombia was a poet, and he was an admirer of Rubén Darío's poetry, and then he appointed Darío as a consul in Buenos Aires.
That's odd that a Nicaraguan would be a government official for Colombia. How much of this novel is invented fiction and how much is based on real history?
Well, you know, the history of Darío is so attractive that it is not almost necessary to invent anything about the personality and about the history, personal history of Rubén Darío. This contrast of a poet being born in a very poor country and being received as a hero by everybody in Nicaragua, even when they have not read them, and the personality of Darío, he was an alcoholic. Because he was a very low-key man, he like always came apart from everybody. He's an enormous personality to be a character.
It seems that in this country there's little awareness of anything that happens, even in Mexico, let alone below Mexico, unless there's a major crisis or somebody like Hugo Chavez. Presents himself
on the
world scene, or there's some drug trade story to be told. Is that frustrating for someone in Nicaragua, for example? I'm sure Guatemala or an intellectual in Guatemala or one of the other Central American countries.
Well, yes, it is. It is. I have the personal experience with Nicaragua during the revolution in the 80s. Nicaragua was in the headlines, in the papers in the United States. It was a matter of permanent discussion in the Congress. Everybody knew where Nicaragua was. But now nobody cares about the country. Even when the difficulties are there, the problems are the same, perhaps worse than before.
But there's no Cold War anymore.
There is no Cold War anymore.
And yes. Nicaragua, part of what caused all the to-do was that the Sandinistas... allied themselves with Cuba and also got aid from the Soviet Union, and that was a red flag. Today we're seeing something similar with Chavez and Evo Morales.
It is a different situation because you mentioned it. It was the Cold War. The United States, the Reagan administration, was helping to support the army of the Contras to overthrow the Sandinist regime, and the Sandinist regime was receiving support, arms, and war materials from the Soviet Union, who were amidst the Cold War. Now there is any Cold War. There are only governments that are defying the United States in different ways. Chavez, the first of all, that has a lot of oil, has the money to do that. I think Chavez is more important in this bilateral relation of Latin America with the United States, more important than Cuba now. Nobody is caring about Cuba in this country now, excepting in Florida. No?
Yeah, well, partly because Castro is in ill health and it's assumed that he'll die and something will change there. In the case of Nicaragua, interestingly, the Sandinistas remained in power for a while and then were lost power. And now Daniel Ortega is back and seems to see, well, he no longer go to the Soviet Union or Cuba, but really he sees Chavez, I guess, and Morales to a lesser degree as his natural ally.
He's a very close ally of Chavez, of Morales, of Correa. They form this alliance called the ALBA, the countries of the ALBA. But I think Daniel Ortega is only rhetorically an enemy of the United States because he's complaining with all the policies of the United States in Central America related to the financial regulation of the International Monetary Fund, related to the fighting against the drug traffic, the security against terrorism, and so on. I think the United States are satisfied with the conduct of the real behavior of Daniel Ortega, what he say every day against the United States in rhetoric terms.
Well, you became disaffected, and Ernesto Cardenal also has broken with him. And then some supporters of Ortega were upset by his personal scandals and by his recent opposition to abortion rights. So what's happening?
Well, because there is any revolution, no revolution anymore in Nicaragua. There is a lot of corruption.
Wasn't there even during the years, the first Sandinista years?
In the 80s, there was not corruption at all, I would say. But at the end of the revolution, there were people that was involved in act of corruption when we were abandoning the power, abandoning government. But now I would say that the Sandinist front that is in government with Daniel Ortega is likely to the PRI in Mexico, this institutional party of the revolution that was in power for more than 50 years. A very rhetoric attitude against capitalism, imperialism, and so on. But at the end, what is giving in Nicaragua now is a situation of corruption and political clientelism, and Daniel Ortega trying to be reelected in power.
Now, the Sandinista revolution is approaching its 30th anniversary tomorrow. Next year will be its 30th anniversary. Has anybody written a definitive account?
I wouldn't say not. There are different memoirs, different pieces of testimony. I myself did one of these with my book, Adios Muchachos, where I relate my relation with the revolution, my participation.
But it ends, but the title is Adios Muchachos, means you're leaving.
Yes, that is the sense. And there is a memoir of Ernesto Cardenal, another memoir of Gioconda Belli, who is another writer involved in the revolution.
Now, you were living in Berlin when it looked like the Sandinistas, the revolution, was going to succeed. Is that what brought you back home?
The revolution brought me home. I returned to Nicaragua in 1975 to get involved in the struggle against Somoza, and I was incorporated almost immediately to the ranks of the Sandinist Front in the political level, I would say. I never fought dictatorship with arms in hand because I was not a military man in any sense.
And you weren't ready to kill the dictator as
a poet.
Rigoberto Lopez Beres had done.
As a poet, yeah.
You started your own political movement, the Movimiento de Renovación Sandinista.
In the 90s.
Yeah, yes, that was a break with Ortega's?
Our separation from the Sandinist Front, I went with other comrades to form this movement, to try to rescue what we consider real Sandinism, democracy in the ranks of the Sandinist Front and so on. But polarization didn't allow us to go far further because the country was always divided in two fundamental positions. The Sandinist one with Daniel Ortega and the other one, the conservative liberal one with Arnoldo Alemán.
And it's pretty much split down the middle?
Yes.
50-50?
Almost 50-50. There was no room for field positions. This is what happened with polarizations.
Some critics of Ortega's argue that his worldview is outdated. His speeches today are pretty much the same thing as they were during the Cold War, calling for the same kinds of things about the rich and business classes as being the root of all evil, eternal class struggle, etc.
Ortega is frozen in the 20th century's debate about the Cold War, and his speech reflects this old-fashioned view of the war, I would say, in his speech, repeat, because, in fact, he is the most conservative man you can find, ally with the Catholic Church, the right wing of the Catholic Church, to support this prohibition of abortion, for example.
Well, how does that work out? A man who posits himself as a revolutionary.
He's just looking to be consolidating power, and he's in need of alliances with everyone that will give him the possibility to enhance his own power. And this is the reason why he's allied with Cardinal Miguel Obando, who was the most important foe of the revolution in the 80s.
When he returned to power in 2006, you wrote a nonfiction account called Daniel Ortega's Second Coming. Do you feel that you're in a good position to assess the man in the work because you were so close to him? You were the vice president of the country.
Yes, I had a very close personal relationship with Daniel Ortega. I know him very well. I think that it is another Daniel Ortega that is in power now. First reason of all, because we are older now than before. We were young people trying to make a revolution in Nicaragua. There is no room for revolution in Nicaragua now.
Now, in this country, the vice president rarely has much power. Did you have a real role in the government?
Yes, I play a role. I act with the delegation of power that Daniel Ortega gave me, but I had a role.
And do you miss politics at all?
No, just now, no. I am absolutely cured from politics. Now I am very satisfied only with writing.
And as you said, two novels since the novel we've been discussing. And I'm assuming you're working on other things as
well. Yes, of course, just now.
Well, this book is called Margarita, How Beautiful the Sea, in a fabulous translation by Michael B. Miller, and it is published by Curbstone Press. My great thanks to Sergio Ramirez for being with us. And have you been heartened at all by the interest in Nicaragua as you've been on the book tour?
Yes, of course, of course.
Thank you again.
Thank you.
On tomorrow's show, we'll take a look at the growing economic rivalry between China, India, and Japan and what it will mean for the United States. Nam Lee on his fiction debut, which has gotten great reviews. Tim Green, the former NFL defensive end turned novelist. Plus, word maven Patricia T. O'Connor will be taking your calls on our crazy English language. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Blake Nee Schick, Sarah English, and Scott Goldberg. Melissa Egan is the executive producer. Debbie Daughtry was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. Thanks for listening.